want to start off by thinking this morning, casting our minds back this afternoon, to Book of Genesis. And we'll remember in the Book of Genesis, in the third and fourth chapters, we read about the sentence of man. We remember that the third and fourth men on earth were embroiled in a personal and private dispute. And Cain, the third man, destroyed the fourth man, Abel. He slew him. And the question came forth from God, "Where is thy brother Abel?" to Cain. And Cain answered, "I know not. Am I my brother's keeper?" The voice of God came back in response, "What hast thou done? The voice of thy brother's blood crieth unto me from the ground." Now that sad incident, which really began the bloodshed on earth, which has never really stopped since, helps us to think about what God considers when violence like that becomes a problem. "The voice of thy brother's blood crieth unto me from the ground." In the last book of the Bible, that same idea was lifted up when in Revelation there was a symbol of an altar, and the figure was brought of an altar and the blood pouring down from the sacrificial victims. And the voice came from those victims and said, "How long, O Lord, holy and true, dost thou not judge and avenge our blood upon them that dwell upon the earth?" And its existence there in the apocalypse is a sanction from the deity of that voice, a plea from God's servants. There is a time and a place for forgiveness. We know that Christ said when he was being crucified, he said, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." And likewise, Stephen, when he was being crucified, said, "Lay not this sin to their charge." So there is, of course, a time when forgiveness should happen. But there is a time when wickedness, infamy, vice, and cruelty ascends up to the presence of God, and he exacts punishment upon the perpetrators of those crimes. Should we forget? Our God is a consuming fire. Paul tells us it is good to behold the goodness and the severity of God. Toward thee goodness, if thou continue in his righteousness, otherwise thou also shalt be cut off. In many ways, it's not for us to determine when things should be forgiven and when they should not be. God is the judge. God has told us, "Vengeance is mine, I will repay." But the answer from Scripture is given that he will repay. And who he will repay is told us in the words of Scripture in the book of Revelation, even though it takes some interpretation. But that chapter we read in 2 Thessalonians gives us all the clues we need to identify the hideous system, which is the subject really of our address this afternoon. We're not talking about persecutions in general. We know that the history of man has been one of great wickedness and infamy for the most part, and the earth has been stained with the blood of innocent victims throughout many, many generations. But what we're talking about in particular is in context. We remember last week our speaker was telling us, Brother Ewan was telling us about the papal system. That's what we're talking about here. We're not just talking about persecutions in general. We're talking about the persecutions of the largest Christian division on earth. If we were to condense down Islam, Sikhism, Hinduism, Shintoism, all those, Buddhism, down into their separate divisions and factions, we'd find that ahead of all the nations is the Catholic Church in numbers. We've just got masses of people throughout the world who declare allegiance to this system that virtually the whole of South America, all the countries of Europe essentially are primarily, predominantly Catholic. That in itself is a scary thought when we think about the power that therefore this system is able to exert and has exerted in the past. Now then, we might think that no one really would be tempted to forget the cruelties of the past, that we would set up memorials throughout the country, throughout the nations of the earth, and try to remind ourselves of the persecutions of the past. The truth is, there is a strong tendency to forget, a very strong tendency to forget, which maybe in itself is part of a Catholic endeavour to sweep under the carpet some of the things which doesn't do its reputation any good. Successive post-war governments of Britain have tried to forget what has happened under the auspices of the Catholic interests. And what I'm also going to say at the outset is we're not actually going to go too far back in history. There's nothing wrong with doing that, and it would be useful to go back into history, into Fox's Book of Martyrs, to see what was done. But I think in some ways it's useful for us to bring it closer to home if we think about things which have happened more recently. So successive post-war governments of Britain, well, what we have just across the pond there, just across the channel on the east, is the continent of Europe. What's being created there, with Brussels at the headquarters, is essentially the Fourth Reich. The First Reich being the Holy Roman Empire, the Second Reich being the Bismarck government with the Hohenzollerns, the Third Reich being Hitler's Nazi National Socialist Party. Now what we're getting is a unification of all members in a more surreptitious sort of way. We have at the head an unelected person who was brought up in a Jesuit school, Herbert von Rompuy. Or Hermann von Rompuy, is it? So what we have being created under our nostrils is the Fourth Reich. The sad thing is that our politicians in Britain have seemed on crucial moments to forget their history and have forgotten what Europe has been trying to do throughout the past couple of millennia, essentially. And it's not just one party or the other. If you look at all those progressive steps, we had the Treaty of Rome, 1957. It really didn't start off very well. The Treaty of Rome made it clear that the rules which were to be concocted by whoever it was in Europe were there to be kept. It wasn't to be suggestions or recommendations. These were rules. So already the warning signs should have been there. And slowly but surely things got worse. We had the Communities Act, 72. Then Britain joined the European Economic Committee, Community in 73. Then there was the Single European Act, 1986. The Maastricht Treaty started handing over sovereignty to Europe, and we'll remember the Lisbon Treaty, and we don't particularly need to go into the details, that's not our job here, but we have essentially, as a country, had our liberties as an independent state passed over to Europe. The Maastricht Treaty was believed to be in violation of the Act of Treason. It was treason by taking away the authority from the British crown, the British monarch, and giving those powers to Europe. So it's not just Joe Bloggs down the road who might have forgotten history. We can hardly blame the average person on the streets for forgetting history. Many people aren't interested, but people have forgotten who really should have remembered. It doesn't come as a surprise, but the papacy has also desired to forget. Now, when I move on to the next slide, I really need to say that the bulk of this address is going to be post-1900. We're talking about persecutions that have happened in the bygone century, not this current century, the one that's just passed us by. So bear that in mind as we're going through. We could spend hours sifting through bits of history over the time when the papacy has been around, but what we're going to look at, to concentrate on, is the more recent history. This is Pope Pius XII, the Pope who was around in World War II. Take a special note of, at the bottom, what it says, Christmas Message 1946. Some of us were around back then and won't forget that by 1946, World War II was over. It had just finished, and the atrocities were then becoming available to those, like in the British Isles, what had actually gone on, the extent of the massacres conducted by the Nazi Party and so on and so forth. And here's what the Pope had to say. The Church is our mother. Do not ask a mother to speak for or against the one or other of her sons. In the distress of the present, beside which the painful vicissitudes of the past appear dim, during the long years of the war and afterwards, human nature, a prey to innumerable and unspeakable suffering, has shown an unbelievable power of resistance. All very nice words, just what you'd expect, I suppose, from someone who's got to that position of authority by being able to use their tongue in such a way. But yet the message is quite clear. Let us forget the past. Pope Pius XII knew all about what had gone on in World War II and was particularly keen, in the interests of the Catholic Church, that all those things which had gone on weren't dug up and hung out to dry in the presence of the public. He wanted everyone to forget. I'm going to concentrate on Pope Pius XII here through a few slides. It's a bit difficult to merge all the little bits of information together into an address, so it might be a bit disjointed, but hopefully we can just pick up the details and get the message clearly enough. Pope Pius XII, Eugenio Pacelli, came into power, I believe it was the late 1930s, at latest, it was early 1940s. And he came to his position as the Pope at that crucial moment where Hitler was trying to spread the Third Reich, the power of the Third Reich across the continent of Europe. And Pope Pius XII, surprisingly to many people, was embroiled in everything. The papacy has always been interested and involved in the politics of the planet, and it was no different in World War II. What may be surprising to the average person is where the allegiances of the papacy were. This is Ribbentrop. Von Ribbentrop was the foreign minister to Italy, so Ribbentrop would have had close dealings with Mussolini, who was the despot of Italy at the time, the equivalent of Hitler in Germany. And here's what he had to say. This was sent from the Vatican in 1940, so everything was in full sway in 1940. They'd already gone into Poland, they'd started the extermination of the Jews, everything was in full swing. Now, after the Minister of Foreign Affairs of the Reich had transmitted the Führer's compliments, the Pope opened the interview by recalling his 17 years of activity in Germany. He said that those years passed within the orbit of German culture certainly constituted the most pleasant period of his life, and that the government of the Reich, Hitler's Germany, could be assured that his heart beat, and always would, for Germany. Has the papacy changed? When we ask that question, have the cruel persecutions of the past been forgotten? We don't have to look into the distant past. There's more to come. This is a Christmas message of 1942. Bear in mind, as we said, that Hitler invaded Poland in 1939. And it was instantly a plan of Hitler, with his Lebensraum and things like that, to make way for Germans, to clear out the Jews. By the time 1942 had come along, the state of Croatia had been allied and brought within the axis of Mussolini's Italy and Hitler's Germany. And the atrocities which were being committed in Croatia were in full swing. Now, I'm not going to go into much detail with the persecutions. Suffice it to say that as 600,000 Christians and Jews were killed in Croatia, and 6 million Jews were killed throughout Europe, as well as countless others in battles, that there were lots of cruelties conducted. And we're not going to go into the torture. There was plenty of torture there. Lots of insane cruelty and unkindness. We might hint at it in some places, but without wishing to bring the tone down in this address, I'll just say it happened. And if anyone doubts it, then the history books are all there and you can read it for yourself. Well, what does the Pope have to say about it all? This is not the time for lamentation, but action. Fired by the enthusiasm of the Crusades, may the worthiest Christian rally to the cry. It is God's will, ready to serve and to sacrifice themselves like the Crusaders of long ago. We exhort and beg you to comprehend in all its fullness the terrible gravity of the present circumstances. You who volunteer to join in this modern holy crusade, lift up the banner and declare war upon the darkness of a world which has strayed from God. Remember that George Bush once used the word crusade in relation to Iraq, and it was deemed by most people to be maybe the not best choice of words. George Bush was not always the best when it came to choosing words, but Pope Pius XII knew what he meant when he said crusade. He knew what a crusade was. The crusades in the past were when the Pope gave sanction to people to take their swords, their spears, their instruments of warfare and go and massacre people in Jerusalem, and to convert or destroy people to turn them over to Catholicism. Not only that, the Pope would have been aware that essentially a crusade was already on the go. Afterwards, Pope Pius XII claimed that he didn't know much about what was going on. We come to that. But he was very much involved from the very beginning. Back in 1938, when Hitler was coming to power, he was voted in democratically. It was quite clear already that he was a bunch of thugs, just like we see in Greece at the moment now. There's no hiding the fact that this Black Party are a bunch of thugs. That was the same with the Nazi Party. When people voted for the Nazi Party, it was, as I see it, largely inexcusable. But they did, and Hitler came to power, and he was elected in as the Nazi Party. Pope Pius XII signed a concordat with Hitler, with Franz von Papen's assistance, to withdraw the Zentrum party from politics. The Zentrum party was the centre party. It was the Catholic party within the cabinet of Germany. And the Pope, by removing the centre party from politics, was removing another obstacle to Hitler's absolute control. Furthermore, there was a chancellor there, so there was the Hitler who termed himself Führer, and there was the chancellor as well, just like I suppose you see in Russia, you have a prime minister and a president, I believe. Well, in the same way, there was a chancellor in Germany called Hindenburg, and he was very wary of Hitler. He was more old school military, and he wasn't too keen on the thuggish mentality of Hitler, although he probably had no idea how bad he was. Franz von Papen happened to be a friend of Hindenburg, and that turned out to be his undoing. And Franz von Papen persuaded Hindenburg to hand over the chancellorship to Hitler. Now, what's significant about that? Well, Franz von Papen was an avid Catholic. An avid Catholic. He was the privy chamberlain to the Pope. So what we can see here is the papacy getting closely involved in the politics of Nazi Germany. More to follow. This is in a book actually before the war, before World War II, that is, and this was a book which Pacelli, before becoming Pope, actually prefaced. In that book, this German Jesuit, Friedrich Muckermann, said, "The Pope is calling for a new crusade. He is the guide who bears the flag of the Kingdom of Christ. Catholic action is sounding the assembly of world Catholicism. It must live its name of heroism. The new era can only be won at the price of bloodshed for Christ." All the warning signs were there. I suppose people didn't really believe them. But sooner or later they were going to put their words into actions. Now this is François Charles Roux, an ambassador of France to the Vatican, and in January 1940 he said that the Pope was perfectly aware what cruelties the Germans were committing in Poland. He also knew of the hardships they were imposing on the Czechs in Bohemia and Moravia. The evidence of German cruelties is so abundant that Pius XII no longer feels entitled to doubt it. This was as it was going on in 1940. And with the knowledge that the Catholic Church has, it's one of the best centres of information there is, with all the priests and the people who are sent to their work throughout the world. It's really a hub of information. So we would be greatly surprised if the Pope wasn't aware of most of what was going on throughout the world. We're going to talk a little bit about Nuremberg. Nuremberg was the place where the people who had committed all the atrocities of Nazi Germany were convicted. Many of them were convicted to death. For the most part, Nuremberg was a miscarriage of justice because many of the people in the Nazi party got away virtually scot-free. But here was an attempt from Pope Pius XII to get Hans Frank, who was the governor of Poland, free. Now, Hans Frank was someone who had a few million corpses to his name because he had been governor of Poland. And Poland was, of course, where Auschwitz was and where most of the crimes against the Jews were committed. It's the most notorious of all the concentration camps, or extermination camps, as it ought to be called correctly. Dr. Alfred Cyril, Frank's lawyer, stated that Pope Pius XII had addressed to the Council of Inter-Allied Control an appeal for clemency in favour of Frank. The doctor was informed of this intervention by Cardinal Paul Haber Archbishop of Munich who transmitted Pope Pius XII's appeal. And here's another one, Greiser. And he was an organiser of the extermination of Jews in Poland also. He was actually the first one, Greiser, who was given the job of Hitler of carrying out his plans of clearing out Poland of the Jews and making way for Germans. So Pius XII sent a message to the Polish government, asking that Greiser be reprieved. Not a single Pole will find an ounce of pity in his heart for the bloodthirsty executioner of the nation. Official circles qualify Pius XII's intervention as stupefying. Now, moving back to Nazi Germany. We're going to look at just a handful of his henchmen in the parties. Heinrich Himmler is one of the most notorious for having really been the mastermind behind the concentration and extermination camps. He was also, of course, the head of the SS. So, not really a nice guy. Now, this man, Heinrich Himmler, had a very Catholic family. His father headed a Catholic school at Munich, his uncle was a Jesuit, and his brother a Benedictine monk. What about him? Well, the SS had been organised by Himmler according to the principles of the Jesuit order. The rules of service and spiritual exercises prescribed by Ignatius de Loyola constituted a model which Himmler strove carefully to copy. Absolute obedience was the supreme rule. Excuse me. Every order had to be executed without comment. And here's from Adolf Hitler. In Himmler, I see our Ignatius de Loyola. It shows Hitler understood what was going on from the Catholic point of view. Obviously, he was the head of it all, and he was making sure his plans were being executed. But Hitler knew what lots of other people might not know, that Ignatius de Loyola was the founder of the Jesuits. And Hitler saw in Himmler someone who could carry out with the same mercilessness as the Jesuits his plans to perfection, and could, like the Jesuits, obey supreme command without question. Without considering the rights or wrongs of it all, they could carry out the plans, wicked or whatever. And certainly Himmler was this kind of person. He was someone who actually stumbled into one of his concentration camps once. And having seen someone shot and some of the stuff landing on his jacket, was physically sick. What it demonstrates is that this wasn't just a psychopath. This wasn't someone who was mad. This was someone who understood what he was doing and was carrying out what he was doing deliberately in full knowledge of the purpose he was striving to accomplish. Joseph Goebbels, successful propaganda minister for the Nazis, was brought up in a Jesuit school. The relationship between National Socialism and Catholicism is particularly striking if one studies more closely the party's methods of propaganda and internal organisation. It is known that Joseph Goebbels was brought up in a Jesuit college. Every page, every line of his writings recalls the teaching of his masters. There is the stress placed on obedience, which was to be the principal virtue of National Socialism, the disdain of truth. Some lies are as necessary as bread, he proclaimed, by virtue of a moral relativism from the writings of Ignatius de Loyola. Franz von Papen, we've mentioned, who was the privy chamberlain to the Pope and another avid Catholic. Now we've got some information on what he said. He said the Third Reich is the first power in the world not only to recognise, but also to put into practice the high principles of the papacy. Do you know what? I think he was right. Nazism, he said, is a Christian reaction against the spirit of 1789. 1789, we know, is the French Revolution. And the French Revolution put an end to the Holy Roman Empire when Napoleon defeated consecutively in the crucial battles and decisive battles the Austrian forces. And by creating that freedom of liberty and diffusing that freedom throughout Europe by his conquests, Napoleon was reversing the influence of the Catholic Church. Franz von Papen saw Nazism as a potential for reversing what had happened in the French Revolution. The former Vice Chancellor of the Reich, Franz von Papen, was nominated Privy Chamberlain to His Holiness John 23rd on 24th of July 1959. Mr. von Papen was condemned to 8 years hard labour by the tribunal for his collaboration with Nazism. Now then, you probably haven't grasped the significance of that just on the first reading. Look at the date. October 1959. Who was the Pope? Pope Pius XII had gone. He was dead. Now it's His Holiness John 23rd. Once again, Franz von Papen is Privy Chamberlain to the papacy. And if that's not an endorsement of his work in the Nazi Germany, then I don't know what is. Did the papacy think he'd done a bad job? Obviously not. Adolf Hitler. Adolf Hitler was a character who was very autocratic, and he had all the usual characteristics of a dictator. And I don't believe that when Adolf Hitler was in power that he was thinking only of the interests of the Catholic Church. From what we can tell from just trying to read his motives in history, it doesn't appear that he was a puppet of the Catholic Church. What he would have done if he had established his plan of creating a Third Reich which would rule for 1,000 years, we don't know. No doubt the Catholic Church would have been in there somewhere. What we can say with certainty is that he admired the hierarchy of the Catholic Church and involved people in his party who were staunch Catholics. Here's what he has to say. I learned most of all from the Jesuit order. So far there has been nothing more imposing on the earth than the hierarchical organisation of the Catholic Church. A good part of that organisation I have transported direct to my own party. The Catholic Church must be held up as an example. I will tell you a secret. I am founding an order. Recorded in 1939. Being an Austrian, we wouldn't expect anything different of Hitler, given that for someone to say they're an Austrian is virtually for them to say they're a Catholic. Austria is a predominantly Catholic country with one of the highest populations of Catholicism in Europe. And the Crooked Cross, the swastika, I believe, may have had some roots in a Catholic church which he saw once in his youth. So it's not surprising at all for him to show such respect to the Catholic Church and to pay such deference, or that he agreed to sign the Concordat with Pacelli, Pius XII. This is Franco, who was the dictator of Spain. When Hitler died, he told his Spanish papers to put this in. Adolf Hitler, son of the Catholic Church, has died defending Christianity. It is understandable that our pen cannot find words with which to deplore his death when it was able to find so many to extol his life. Above his mortal remains rises his victorious moral figure. With the crown of martyrdom, God gives to Hitler the laurels of victory. A victorious moral figure. It's really one of those things where you have to pinch yourself and think, is this real? If it was in isolation, you might think it was just an aberration or a misprint. But the fact that we've got so much information and so much from the Catholic Church in support of Hitler, we realise that yes, this is reality. Moving on to Croatia. Pope Pius XII granted a private audience to Pavelić and his suite. From the Vatican, Pavelić had but a short distance to travel that evening to reach the Palace of Venice, where Mussolini was waiting him. There, the two accomplices signed a treaty delimiting Italy and Croatia, whereby Italy was assigned in the Croatian coast and thus was incorporated in the Axis, the state of Croatia. So the Pope was there to get him involved, anti-Pavelić. So Croatia and the papacy, what are some of the people involved in Croatia? Well, anti-Pavelić was a rogue. And it's enough to say, I suppose, that by the time he was done, there were 600,000 people less in his country. Less Protestants, that is, and Jews. This is the kind of guy he was. He who could not cut away a child from his mother's womb is not a good Ustashi. His Ustashi were his the equivalent of the SS. Another famous quote, "This is a gift from my faithful Ustashis, 20 kilograms of human eyes." I've spared ourselves some of the worst quotations, but there's one more on the Ustashis, who, as we said, were his henchmen to conduct his dirty work. And just to get the message across, I'll read this from a survivor in a massacre of the Church of Glina. The Ustashis gathered a few hundred peasants. This is just random peasants. No one who's been convicted of anything, no trial or anything. They were just taken from the village, from the outskirts, and the Ustashis explained to us that we were to attend church to hear a Te Deum sung for the longevity of Poglavnik and of the independent state of Croatia. Inside of the church, we heard a truck stop in front of the church, and very soon, a large group of Ustashis entered armed. And we can figure out what happened. Then suddenly, silence seemed to reign in the church, and I caught sight of the flickering candles which still shone on the desecrated altar. Very disturbing. These were the kind of people that we're dealing with, all endorsed by the papacy. Was it endorsed by the papacy? Pope Pius XII was there at the very beginning and continued to give his support to Pavelić. May 1941. The most touching moment was when the young Ustashis begged the Pope to bless Pavelić, the independent state of Croatia, and the Croatian people. Each member received a medal as a souvenir. This was when they went to the Vatican. So this is what you get for massacring people like those 300 in that church. You get a medal from the Pope. He also sends messages to Pavelić. This was on the anniversary of his enthronement, March 1942. "To Your Excellency's humble felicitations, we reply with our thanks and our wishes for Christian prosperity." That is in Croatia. By Christian, we can only assume that he means Catholic. Because if you weren't a Catholic in Croatia at this time, then you were in trouble. January 1943. "For all that you have expressed to us both in your own name and in that of Croatian Catholics, we thank you and joyfully send the apostolic benediction to you and to the Croatian people." It was a telegram at the New Year. Continues, 1944. the wishes which you and the Croatian people have expressed to us upon the occasion of the fifth anniversary of our pontificate are very dear to us, and we pray that God may bless you with his most gracious gifts. Have we got the message? The Pope was in league with these people, with Hitler, with Mussolini. We haven't talked about Mussolini, we could have. But he was in league with Mussolini as well, and with Ante Pavelic and Major Machenko, the other cruel persecutor of the Protestant Christians in Croatia. This is the system we're dealing with. Just so we don't feel alone in our condemnation of the Catholic Church and what they've done, there was actually a team of people in Cardiff University who decided to ask the question in one of their dissertations, should the Pope be tried for war crimes? One of the Italian campaigners for election in Italy declared in his campaign that he believed the Pope was a war criminal. If it wasn't for the Pope, we can be sure he would have been probably tried and found guilty. Charles Dickens had this to say about the papacy. He described it as the most horrible means of political and social degradation left in the world. Gladstone said that Catholicism is hostile to intellectual liberty and incompatible with the principle and trend of modern civilization. It arouses unwarrantable pretensions to govern and threatens the rights of the family. It tends to undermine the soul's love of truth. It alienates cultured minds in whatever country it is professed, and wherever it reigns, saps the morality and strength of the state. And just having looked at some of those slides already, we realise that what he said was vindicated. The Church of Rome is the most formidable combination that ever was formed against the authority and security of civil government, as well as against the liberty, reason and happiness of mankind. Adam Smith. From the sole of the foot to the crown of the head, she is one mass of spiritual putrefaction. When to this is added her great swelling words of vanity, her proud looks, her rapacious deeds, her wicked principles, cruel acts, malignant hostility to the truth in every shape and form, her implacable persecution by rack, torture, fire and death of all who professed it, whom she could get into her power, the picture of her enormities is complete. Robert Roberts. The papacy, 1,000 times more fertile in lies, dupery and immorality than any other theatre in the world, Volpi, who was a privy chamberlain to the Pope. How can wrath cease against men so long as the earth is cursed with the presence of Catholicism and its kindred abominations? The divine indignation can only be appeased by their extirpation, total and complete. Roman Catholicism was born in blood, has wallowed in blood, has quenched its thirst in blood, and it is in letters of blood that its true history is written. So it's not just us. More to the point, has God forgotten? And here we need to look at our scriptures. We're going to start off with our introductory reading in 2 Thessalonians 2. A speaker last week explained this for us, so we don't need to start from scratch and expound this chapter to us. We know that Paul was talking about the apostasy which developed from the truth into what he called a man of sin, the son of perdition, a system of iniquity. And that there would be someone who opposed and exalted himself above all that is called God, and that he would sit as God in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. Verse 7. The mystery of iniquity doth already work, only he who now letteth will let, until he be taken out of the way. Then shall that wicked be revealed, whom the Lord shall consume with the spirit of his mouth, and shall destroy with the brightness of his coming. So God hasn't forgotten. the subject is not yet closed, and the atrocities which have been committed by the Catholic Church are going to come into remembrance before God, and they are going to be given double for their sins. That wicked is going to be destroyed by God, which is a clear indication to us that God isn't going to just forget about all that this system has done. The system needs to be rooted out from earth for peace, righteousness and prosperity to prevail amongst mankind. Because so long as there is this tyrannical, wicked system, it will suffocate liberty and freedom to do righteousness. Daniel 7 is the next one. Some people might think our language can be strong at times. What we must remember is that the words of Scripture are as strong as anything that we could expect to think up or say. In Daniel chapter 7, we have the prophecy of four consecutive empires of the world. The fourth one being Rome, has continued in different forms up until the present. It's not the same empire as it was, but it's still there. It's still there enthroned in the Vatican. More power is to be given to the papacy at some point. At the moment, it's been stripped of the power it once had, so that I can stand here and say these things without fear of someone knocking on the door and taking me to the rack. But it's going to have power restored to it, and all those things which it wanted to do in World War II, it's going to do. It's going to assert absolute control over Europe. And at this time, we read in verse 21 that the same horn made war with the saints, prevailed against them, and the Ancient of Days came, judgment was given to the saints of the Most High, and the time came that the saints possessed the kingdom. And the fourth beast has a fate different to the others. It's in verse 25, it says, "He shall speak great words against the Most High, and shall wear out the saints of the Most High, and think to change times and laws, and they shall be given into his hand until the time and times and the dividing of time." So again, all the characteristics we read of in 2 Thessalonians 2. "The judgment shall sit, and they shall take away his dominion to consume and to destroy it unto the end." That's the fate, the fourth beast. So, we've just whet the appetite for next week's address, as I believe it is, or maybe the week after, about the downfall of Rome, the eternal city. We don't want to speak too much on that subject. We just need it to turn to these verses to demonstrate that God hath not forgotten the wickedness of this system. In Revelation 18, which we won't turn to, it says, "God hath remembered her iniquities." It's for us too to not forget the iniquities of this system. And we must, all, each and every one in this country, hear the words of Scripture which call out to us and demand their attention. "Come out of her, my people. Come out of that great system of Babylon, that ye be not partakers of her evil deeds."